Welcome to Coffee with Catholic Workers, a podcast from and about folks involved in the Catholic worker movement. I'm Theo.
And I'm Lydia. We've both been active in the Catholic worker for the past decade, and we're excited to introduce to you some of our favorite people from the movement.
On today's episode, we're talking to Fritz from the Joette Noel Catholic Worker. Fritz tells us about his many adventures that brought him to join the Catholic workers in Amsterdam and shares with us some of the great work happening at other Catholic worker communities around Europe.
Let's go to our conversation.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us this morning, Fritz. We usually like to start out with asking folks, how did you find your way to the Catholic worker movement, your Catholic worker journey?
Yeah. So I know because I love the podcast. So that's the only question I can roll into, because I thought, well, they'll fire that one to me. And it started when I was 17. And I discovered somehow through a classmate, there was a squat movement and a scene in Amsterdam. And so then I had a lead into the squat scene. And then you start discovering anarchy, you know. And it was around 1979, 1980. And there was a huge squat movement in Amsterdam. So it was so super. And so my first barricade that I helped to build, it was around a squat, and it was so great. And we created a free space for a whole weekend. We blocked all the streets, and everybody came, you know, the ultra bourgeois people from the Royal Concert Hall. After the concert, they came and joined at our campfire, and all the squatters and the Moroccan guys, you know, everybody was there. It was so nice. And then I was back in school, and we see the chopper, and we think, oh, they're gonna evict. So we leave school and we bike there. And then I see they took the barrel off a tank and they put a bulldozer on the tank, and it went straight through our barricade, and the barricade was burning. And I remember hoping the tank would suck up the fire and burn itself, but it didn't. It just blasted our barricade. And I realized that I thought that, and I thought, oh, there's also a guy in that tank, and should I think this? So it started out with anarchy and having a little bit difficulty with thinking that tank guy might, you know. And a big part of the squat movement is black bloc, so they had frigidaires, how you call them, ice, you know, how you call them, you see, I'm a foreigner, I'm not native to English. It's a big thing, and you can keep things cool in it. How do you call that in English?
Like refrigerator?
Refrigerator. Yeah, so you put refrigerators on your roof because you find them in the trash. And then if the police comes, you throw the refrigerators on the police, you know, to defend the squad. And I it's a bit much. And also the stones is a bit much. So I was trying to find where am I in this movement? And then I stumble on Bob Marley, and that really gave me a boost. He's not nonviolent, but there came Ja Love and Exodus. We have to stand up and fight for our rights, but especially that there is a Ja who loves us and protects us and helps us and wants an Exodus. There was quite a revelation. And so then in 83, I decided to cut the ropes to the system and stop studying. I'd been studying for a semester, but I really felt like, this is not it. Building church and university, deceiving the people continually, you know, and there you're in this university, and it's, and at that time I was a radical punk. I thought, well, you can study to become a psychologist or a pastor or a genetical engineer, and it's all wrong, because the psychologist helps you back to be a good consumer and a good producer, and the pastor does the same shit, and it's one big filthy system. And now I think, I'm happy there's a dentist who did go through university, you know. So I'm a bit, and my own kids, I say, you reflect on where you go. And so anyway, I'm now 60, so I'm a bit more mild, but I'm so happy I cut the ropes. And then thought, well, if Bob Marley gets his inspiration from the Bible, I better try, because until that, the Bible was mostly if you ran out of cigarette paper, you know, it's very thin paper. So I started trying to read through it, and it was pretty dry stuff and a lot of fighting. There was good stuff in there too, you know, when the people cry for a king and what's his name? The prophet says, oh, you better watch out. Don't do it. And then I stumbled on Jesus, and he, you know, you feel like, whoa, this is the most radical, real anarchist ever. So then I was hooked on Jesus. And then there was in 83, High Days of the Peace Movement, and I found my way in there and helped start a peace camp next to a cruise missile base. Reagan and the NATO wanted to put a new round of missiles in Europe. And I went to live there, and you know, you get evicted all the time, and the police and stuff like that. And I thought God is with me. Oh yeah, and at some point, my dad calls me, and he says, "Fritz, there's a call for military service. We had a draft then, and if you stop with the university, you lose your privileges. So the government says, oh, you do nothing. You have to join the army." And my dad said, well, now it's finished with all this nonsense. Huh? In so many weeks, you have to report at such and such a barracks. And I say, well, dad, sorry, but I'm busy here. I have a garden, you know, vegetable garden. I'm building a chicken coop. That time, the hen evicted us yet. And I'm busy here, you know, so I'm not going there. And my dad was like, oh, no. So anyway, but I thought, geez, God is with me, and I have nothing to do with the government. I didn't have social money or any, you know, just nothing. And they were looking for a certain Ter Kuilen, but they didn't know the face or the fingerprints or anything. So we did some squatting around the base, and when the evictors, I would say to the police, hi, I'm Fritz Mens, which means Mens is the Dutch word for human. So I didn't use my last name. And I thought, well, I can live like this for another 8 or 10 years until the draft. I'm older than the draft. I'm no longer eligible, you know. So, and then at some point in 84, they had evicted us and squashed the whole thing. They burned it down in one night, you know. They gave us 45 minutes and then said, you have to be out of here. So I got my chickens and I bring them to the Franciscans. And then they bulldozed everything and put it on a heap and fired it up. And next morning, it was all corn. So they plowed it all under. And it was quite a big peace camp, you know. So I was very angry and upset. And I like Lonzo Del Vasto. He's a nonviolent resistor who learned stuff from Gandhi. So I did a fast in the village in front of the church saying, hey, people, every 3 seconds, a child is dying of hunger, and every 3 seconds we spend $150,000 on the arms, and what are we doing? And then after that, I got so my your bowels stop, but your head gets very clear when you fast. So after 14 days my teeth started bleeding, and I had so many things that I saw that I could do and that needed to be doing. So I stopped the fast and started doing again. And then I was on the street bringing coffee and tea in the morning for breakfast. Everybody was camping out in front of the mayor's office. You know, they evicted the camp. They thought they'll go home, but we all camped in front of the mayor's office. And I was bringing coffee and tea, and we made the coffee and tea with sort of seats for peace. If you are from the 1980s, it's a collective, and they cook at big actions, and they're anarchists. So I got the coffee and the tea in the morning from the anarchist camp somewhere, the kitchen, and brought it to the mayor's office. And then I hear behind my back, I hear, Mr. Ter Kuilen, will you come along with us? And I thought, somebody knows my last name. And I turned around, and it was two police officers in plain clothes. They put me in a car, a normal car, and they drove me off to the police station. And I thought, oh, well, that's it. And then everybody came to the police station, and but you know, you're in there, and I was thinking, okay. And then they brought me to the military prison, and so I had to adjust a little bit. And then I spent 9 months in prison for the draft resistance, and there somebody sent me a booklet by Dan Berrigan, and it was a translation. And, you know, his texts, you really have to get into them, even in English. But this translation didn't really, I thought, well, there's a good guy there, but it didn't really go deep. But that was my first Denver. And then I got out again and I went back into the peace camp, and somehow I got the nuclear resistor. It's a very nice paper. And there I met the Catholic worker in the form of Plowshares activists. And so I start corresponding, and I really loved that, because I was one. So it was so nice to discover them. And then there were Franciscans in the resistance too at our airbase, and Sister Rosemary Lynch, she came to visit us, and she told us what was happening at the Nevada test site. And then a little bit later, there was a conference for radiation survivors after Chernobyl, and there I met Pauline Esteves, and she was a Western Shoshone, and she told, oh man, I have to cry, but anyway, she told us about what's happening to the Shoshone. You know, they're bombed out with certain nuclear bombs, and it really hit me. Because of all the pressure on these missiles, the cruise missiles and the Pershing 2, Gorbachev and Reagan, they made a deal, the INF treaty. They withdrew only these missile systems to appease the people, and they recycled the warheads and everything. But anyway, so then I thought, next step is we should stop nuclear testing and do something about that. And so I thought, let's do a walk from the East Coast to the Nevada test site. And there was a Native American in our peace camp, and he said, good idea, but hold your breath a little bit. And this was 1987 when the idea came, and do it in 1992 when it's 500 years after Columbus. And then you also apologize to us for what you guys have done to this wonderful continent. And you say, hey, we can't undo history, but let's at least stop bombing the Western Shoshone. So I said, great idea, and it gives more time to prepare. So then I started preparing for this walk in 1992, and it was 1988. During Lent, I went to Nevada to see and experience, to see Pauline and Corbin and meet, you know, and Rosemary and DE, and participate in the resistance there. I spent a month at the test site, and there I met Art Laffin. And during the weekdays, I camped in a trailer or van from NDE. And in the weekends, it was too full, so I sleep in the desert. And then there was something that I didn't sleep out, but I slept with Art in a very small tent. And Art's a big guy, you know, and we were there in this small tent, and the sun comes up in the desert, you know, and it's so burning hot. And anyway, we had a great time in that tent. And I was looking for places to start the walk on the East Coast. And so first I went to the tracks at Concord, where Brian Wilson lost his legs because it was a peace camp and I wanted to breathe there. And then I went to see Jack and Felice in Tucson, and that's from the nuclear resistor. And that's where they train the soldiers to operate the cruise missile system in Europe. And we vigiled there at the Davis-Monthan Air Base. And then I took a bus up. Art was living then with Elmer Maas near the electric boat company, somewhere New Haven or Groton, up there, you know, a little bit northeastern. And I'm there, and I see the place, so I let it work in me, and I think it was a boat launch. So we vigil when all these people come to cheer this launch of another sub. And then I say, Art, I want to go to New York to talk with the War Resisters League and others, Can you help me out? Can you find me somewhere, a place? And Art said, yeah, I have to go to DC. I'll drop you off at some friends. So Art, we drive down, we drive south, and Art drops me off in the evening at Mary House. And I knock on the door, and it's already a bit dark, and it's drizzling, and there are fires on the street corners, and nobody opens up, and a guy comes up and says, hey, man, hey, got a quarter? And I'm thinking, whoa, where am I, you know? And I bang a bit more on the door, and finally somebody opens up and says, oh, you're coming here? Oh, well, all right. And he shows me some office on the first floor, and I roll out my sleeping bag there. And then I spent like a week or 10 days at St. Joe's. And I think, well, I got to earn my keep. So I'll do the soup in the morning. So I wash all the bowls. And then in the afternoons, I'll go to the War Resisters and demonstrations and meet people and talk about this idea of the walk. And I think, well, these Catholic workers, they're so good on pacifism and anti-militarism. And they fill the prisons. You know, Felton was there. He was just out of prison, or he was going back into prison. But what's this soup? You know, I didn't get it. And then I went down the East Coast a bit more and met other people. And anyway, then we started to walk at St. Mary's, Georgia, and where the Atlantic Trident Fleet is. John and Martina Linehan were living there then. And then after the walk, at the end of 92, I stayed in Las Vegas to help out with Nevada Desert Experience, because what's the running mate of Clinton? Al Gore. So Al Gore was pushing to resume nuclear testing. And so it wasn't a final cut yet. So I helped out to help organize the direct actions there during Lent and after. And then I fell in love with Julia already before, and Gary and everybody at the worker there, and I helped out there. And slowly, you know, the soup, it had dawned on me already. And then in 93, I decided, when there was a new energy secretary who was from the civilian nuclear power, so not from the military side, but from this, and she was okay with no longer doing active nuclear tests on the Shoshone land. And there was the war in Yugoslavia was raging, and I thought, okay, I'll go back to Europe and I'll go and help try to give a civilian answer to this war, because they were sending in the military to squash it, but I think we people can be better peacemakers than the military. So I went back to Europe. But before I went back, I thought I should deal with my prison sentences, because I had still some sentences out for actions from before I left for the US. So I wrote to friends in Holland. Hey, guys, there has been built a deportation prison in Amsterdam, the first real one. We did some actions at a decrepit building they were using for that purpose before, to liberate the prisoners. But this was a real prison they built for deportations. So I said, shall we do an action there? And then I thought, well, I'll get arrested at that action and serve my time. So I wrote that idea to friends. And then I get a letter from the Jeanette Noël House in Amsterdam, Amsterdam Catholic worker, super enthusiast. They said, yeah, we're in on this. Let's go and let's do it. And I thought, wow, there's a Catholic worker in Amsterdam too. So, now I've been living here for quite a while already.
That is quite the journey, of a little bit of both, like a quite the personal journey, but also quite the global journey of experiencing and finding the Catholic worker on multiple continents.
Yeah.
With the Catholic worker primarily being in the U.S., I mean, the majority of the houses are in the U.S. Do you have any thoughts on why that might be, on why it hasn't necessarily caught on or expanded the same way in Europe?
Well, what I'm now going to blurt out is just a blurt out, a shoot from the hip, and a very limited perspective, and far, you know, so I think... here in Northwestern Europe has the social welfare state is very strong, and the mentality of the social welfare state is very strong. So the people shove off all trouble to the government, and the government takes it and runs with it. So that's one part of it. Whereas in the US, there's less government on that side, and people feel more responsible themselves. And also Europe is way ahead of you in the de-Christianization. You know, God is gone. In America, there are still churches that are sort of full. And here in the Bible Belt, you have them. But the main Protestant and Catholic churches, they're drying up. And Europe is a lot ahead of that with you. So that's another one. But we're countering that. So they're sprouting up little Catholic worker communities in Europe. So.
So you mentioned that one thought is that there's just like a greater, what we in the US would call like a social safety net for people where you are. So what does the Catholic worker house work look like then for you all at Jeanette Noel?
Well, I the Noel House from the start, because we offer hospitality to illegalized migrants and refugees, and the government only oppresses them, but doesn't do much for them. Well, there's camps and refugee camps and processing and bureaucracy, but you got to be lucky to enter that. And there's a lot of people who can't enter it, or it takes time to enter that system. So the society and the government says, oh, you're not allowed to be here, and we'll illegalize you and we'll downpress you. And I love it that we say, welcome, you know, and that we mirror back to society. Hey, I think that's a powerful statement. That what you do to the least, you do to Christ, and the least are certainly the people we illegalize. So we try to bring that message to the churches, and I think it works. There's no denying it, you know. So it's a, and I love that solidarity. So when you're sleeping, you're sleeping solidarity, and when you're waking up and you stumble into the kitchen, you're making coffee. It's a whole life. Well, what all Catholic workers do, but I love it that we focus on illegalized migrants who are downpressed by the system, so that's the main core, I would say, of what we do is offer hospitality to about a dozen, sometimes 18, sometimes 10. Illegalized migrants. And then I think prayer is quite something too, you know. So luckily we have a chapel in the heart of the house, and it's on the corridor, and the windows to the corridor are glass, and the curtain is open if we don't pray. And then there's a Franciscan cross of Jesus, you know, the one from San Damiano. In the night, there's a spot on it, and we have morning prayer, afternoon prayer, and the evening prayer, and I think that's very important too. Sometimes there's tensions in the community, and that you still come together and pray and sing and be silent. I think it's a very essential thing of what we do that keeps us going. And then I think since Suzanne had the idea in 1989, I think, we always squat land. So our first squatted land, after 13 years, they bulldozed it over to make a freeway even bigger. And then we wanted, my youngest son and me, we have a tricycle, and it's parked behind the church. And we were going out to squat new land, a real nice corner. So we go there. And then the developers had come, and they had bulldozed the whole thing. Oh, it was really a shock. So we bring back the tricycle to the church, and back on the back of the church. And we see there's a whole field of blackberries brush behind the church. And we think, well, we can make a fireplace here. So we asked the church, and it's piety, so it's non-intellectual, non-university Dutch and migrant Catholics who are people's piety, so to speak. And they are very much into what Rome wants, you know, that's okay. And so they're that kind, there's a lot of Latin in there, but nobody studied Latin or anything. So it's that kind of a parish. And Philly is a woman, and she's in charge. You know, there are priests living there and everything, but Philly is in charge. So we asked Philly, hey, Philly, can we make a little fireplace here for the kids and for, you know, to enjoy it? And Philly said, yeah. And the man, you know, the man said, oh, fires, and what's that? And oh, but if you got Philly on your side, you know, it's so we start making a fireplace, and we first build a little chapel for Mary, because you know it's there, so that Mary protects us a bit from the, because we're Catholic workers and not totally on the Vatican that time, John Paul II side. So, and then that was in the winter of 2014, and then in spring, Gerard Mormon he kicked off the house. He said, "Look, I have a little pumpkin seedling." So I say to Philly, Gerard has a pumpkin seedling. Can we plant it? And she said, yeah, sure. So we clear some more brushes and we plant the pumpkin seedling. And then my wife thought, aha, this is a gated garden, because the other squat land, there was rowdy kids coming and the soil was not so good. And but this was gated and good soil. And she went like bang with her friends. They're all elderly Chinese women who had lived at the house in the days when they were illegal. And they started plowing up and getting rid of shrub and stuff. And they started the first vegetable garden. And then I have friends, you know, other in another community, the grass is always greener because you don't know everything that's under the hood. So with the kids, I used to visit, and there's a Catholic worker living there. Well, she's German, but she lived at the Tacoma Catholic Worker for quite a while. It's in Austria, and they really live Peter Morin's vision. So they have super prayers three times a day. They have some two little hogs that grow big and then are butchered. They have chickens, rabbits. They have various wheat, barley, you know, that kind of stuff, potatoes, vegetables. They fire it with wood from the forest around. They have solar panels for water and electricity. And they dip candles. And, you know, Chuck Trapkus would also love it. It's just the place. So we go there with the kids. And then at some point, one of them there gives me a little paper bag with some peach pips, you know. And so he plants the peach pips in my heart, but I'm impatient. I can't wait to get, you know, that takes too long. So I asked Peter, and he's from Benedictine Monastery, the orchard man, and he knew everything. He knows everything about fruit. I said, Peter, can you get me a peach tree? So Peter gets me a peach tree. And then I want to plant it at the parish building, so where the priests live, on the south wall, and guide it along the wall, because we're pretty north, and if it gets the heat from the stones, I think we could grow peaches. So I'm planting it there, and there was black fabric under the little stones that are there to against weeds. So I stop, and I ask Leobard, he's the husband of Philly, Leobard, what do you think? Well, shall I just plow through and go bang to put it in, or what shall I do? Leobard looks a bit, and he looks around a bit. And by then, the parish had also started to get rid of brambles, and it had turned into a lawn. And he says, well, I think you can put it on the lawn. So we plant the peach tree on the lawn, and I think, whoa, this lawn, it could be turned into an orchard. So I get fruit trees, and not the low ones. Nowadays, they're all low fruit trees, apple, pear, you know, so they can be harvested greedy and efficiently. But when I was young, we had high-rise apple and peach trees, and not peach, pear, and you know, there were real trees. So I get these old race high apple and pear and prune trees, and I get too many on purpose. And so we plant them, and I say to the neighbor, she lives in the farm next to the church, I say to her, Lot, I got some fruit trees, but they're too many. You think I can plant some on the deserted stretch of land along the railroad behind you? And she had a bridge there from the farmer from way back when I was still farming. And she said, yeah, sure, you go ahead. So we plant the fruit trees there. And then my wife and her friends, they think, well, there's more land. And then we cross the ditch. It's a 4-meter ditch through the bridge of Lot, the neighbor. And we start growing there. And now we have about 2 acres of land, mostly squatted on the railroad land. And a bit is on Bishop's land. And so we farm about 2 acres. And it's like 5 miles down to downtown, and 3 miles to the end of the city. So we're in the city farming about 2 acres with a fireplace. And, you know, we have eco-feminist fires, and we have full moon fires, and we have wild church liturgies, and wood chopping. And it's a blessing. So we also do that and as one of our things. And you're asking, so what do you do? And then we do quite a bit of that. So, Suzanne has, 100, 200 days in prison ahead of her for actions. I did a month last year in prison. And so we do anti-nuclear actions. And Margriet, she was at the birth of Extinction Rebellion at the London Catholic Worker. And Martin, who lives there, was in the group that helped give birth to the whole Extinction Rebellion movement and concept. He'd been working on it for 2 years before it came into fruition, and it kicked off straight away with a Christian climate action component. So Margriet came back with this concept of Christian climate action, and that's really taking off in Holland too now, and we're in the midst of that as well. Like on Ash Wednesday, we organized the Ash Wednesday liturgy on the tracks in the harbor. There's a lot of ships with coal from Colombia and all over the world that are unloaded here and then put on the trains, coal trains, to northwestern Europe, where it's burnt in incinerators. And it's bad stuff, you know, this coal. So we, and Ash Wednesday is a good day to reflect on coal and ashes. So we organize an Ash Wednesday liturgy, and a lot of us get arrested. And so we do, and soon we'll block a freeway. It's the start of a freeway in between the parliament and the Ministry of Economy and Climate. It's one ministry, a department of the government, and there's a freeway just between the two of them, and we'll block that. And and my personal, and luckily also Nikki and Mieke, so from us, another Catholic worker now started, Dorothy Community, their farm just out of Amsterdam. And we work together to spread the, I don't know, Christian way is not the right word, because Christian has not a good taste in the mouth, but the Extinction Rebellion as a movement, it has a very us-them dynamic in Holland. So we're the good guys and the police are the bad guys. And you link arms and you resist arrest. So when you're blocking this freeway, you make a carpet of people, and the police really have to pain you to loosen you up. And you're sitting in that carpet. I don't do it because I believe I'm not fighting the flesh of this officer. He's my brother or she. We're fighting against the spirit of that we don't care about the planet and that we only care about profit. It's that spirit we're fighting and not this guy. So we're forming a rise up little group who say, well, if the officer summons us, will rise up and will walk with him to the paddy wagon and get processed, and will take the fines and will protest them and go to court and ask the judge to decide for life and not the death. And so we're, and a lot of the climate movement, they work with lawyers and the whole court system, they glue, you know, you put glue on your fingerprints and you go anonymous, and we try to say, hey, you can just be cheerful, talk with the cop and witness and try to win them over. So we're trying to spread that spirit of joyful non-fear for the cops into the movement. That's also quite a thingy that we are joyfully doing. Boy, I'm talking, and now I'll listen to you guys.
Well, you have a lot to talk about, a lot going on there with hospitality and farming and climate protests, but also nuke protests and peace work. That's a lot to be going on. What are the things that keep you going? So this has now been like a lifetime of work. What is it that keeps you involved with this and being able to push forward in all these areas?
I think it's a mystery, and I would call it Jah love. You know, I'm amazed. It's a fountain, and somewhere it comes up. This love and this energy, and at hard times, just the prayer. Or I was at Mary House in October. Theo and me hung out there, and then I picked up on the rosary. So this morning I first prayed the rosary with the migrant women in our church, and I went to mass, and I could process my life a bit. You know, I'm a maniac. I love to do stuff and do stuff. And the liturgy gets me out of doing into breathing. And so I think it's a liturgy. And then during jogging at my second round, so I do some stuff. And then I put on Bob Marley or other reggae. And that also, then I dance the rest of my jog. And I don't know, it's and community, you know, to do stuff together and have these little interactions, and then it forms. So if I would be an isolated me, I don't know how people in isolation do it. I was 2 weeks in isolation. In Germany, they're still quite into COVID. So they isolated me for 2 weeks, and you know, you breathe through it, and it's okay. But I need community. So I'm a hermit by nature, but I love community. I need it. So it's both. Yeah. I could tell a little bit. Are you going to ask, so what about the Catholic worker movement in Europe or something like that? Was that one of the questions you're going to fire, or what are you going to fire? Fire ahead.
Yeah. Fritz, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the European Catholic workers? I know that there's a number of them. We've already been talking for a little while here. I'm sure you can't get into every detail of every Catholic worker. It would be a whole series of podcasts. But what are some of the vibes you see there? What are some of the more your favorite things that you've seen from the communities? And is there like a certain character to the Europeans that is different than the Americans, do you think?
Nah, that question you can answer when you tour all of us. So I think there's a lot of similarity. We just had, I forgot her name. She was here one day and she'd been at Mary House for a long time. And she said, wow, I step into Catholic worker, you know, so you feel something that's there. But I remember in 90s I came, and then to live here after the Kosovo stuff and so on. And then I was at Oxford. We had a Hope and Resistance Plowshares gathering there, and there was a Catholic worker house. So I go and I visit a bit, and St. Francis House. They just started. And Clive said, next year it's 100th birthday of Dorothy. We should do something. So we say, yeah, let's organize a gathering. And then in 97, we organized the first European Catholic Worker gathering, because by then there was also, we were the first, the Jeanette Noël House.
Yeah, hey.
And then in Hamburg, a soup kitchen, the Kana soup kitchen, had erupted into life. And in Hamburg is Broten Rosen, and then Oxford. And then there was also a Liverpool Catholic Worker. They closed by now, but they were. So we all get together. And since then, we have every year a gathering of European Catholic Workers. And that's really nice, really nice. And I would say most Catholic workers in Europe you live solidarity with illegalized migrants. And then the soup kitchen does a lot of soup in Dortmund and advocacy for homeless people. And together we do actions at nuclear bases and also some climate stuff, like Judith from Hamburg, the Catholic worker there, and me. We jumped with Suzanne from our Catholic worker. We jumped right into the eviction of Lützerath, the climate camp there. 15,000 police, you know, that's a lot of police. And not all of them on the front. A part of them were in barracks and hotels to recharge. And then, so there was, anyway, so we do actions together and we hang out together and we visit each other and we offer hospitality like Catholic workers do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
About how many Catholic workers are there in Europe?
Well, I will go in my, it's the same like who lives in what room, and you have to sort of close your eyes and picture the room and then you see, yeah, so-and-so is living in that room. So there's Scotland in Glasgow, the Catholic worker, and they work with migrants and homeless people and a lot with the Trident submarines. And a new generation is coming of these submarines, you know, if we're unlucky. And then there's London. There's two Catholic workers there. One is a farm and it's within the M25, so within the motorway around London. But it's a real nice farm place at a lake, and you should definitely hang out there, Theo. And then there's a townhouse. They have a whole church building and a rectory, and you should also hang out there. And they do a lot of resistance. And then there's us and I had so much hope that Anna and Herman, they're a young couple and they're really super Catholic workers. Herman knows our house since he is 8 through his mom. And after he graduated from high school, he spent a year at the LA worker. And then he spent a year at a farm Catholic worker. And they lived at another sort of Catholic worker. And then they came to us and he said, well, we'll come for about 3 months and then we'll start our own community. And Anna is a real Catholic worker too. She lived in many, you know, so they're really a couple. You can see them. They're on track for life. And I had hoped, oh, they might, you know, they might. And after 4 years, it was not 3 months, but after 4 years, yeah, they kicked off. And now there's a Dorothy community. Well, they're on the other side of the soccer stadium, about 10-mile bike ride. I love to get an electric car because 10 miles biking. Mm-hmm. But if you're good, you bike there. And they have an e-bike, so they bike easier to us on their e-bike than anyway. So there's the Dorothy community, and then there's Kana Soup Kitchen in Dortmund. And Hamburg, the Broten Rosen Catholic worker, that's a big Catholic worker. In my picture, you know, when I visit there, their rooms are big, everything is big there. So, and it's really, it's really nice. And I should go to London again, but I, with COVID, you know, and then there's the Göteborg Catholic worker. But they're more plowshares. And so I used to think plowshares is all. And now I think, you should be rooted in soup. So they miss the soup. And then there's the mustard seed there, but then in Swedish, senapskornet, up in northern Sweden. And there's Josh and Elizabeth, and Josh is from the US, and they met, I think, at Karen House or somewhere where Carl Cabot was living in the vicinity or in the house. So that's the most northern Catholic worker. And then I count Pinkafeld as the supreme Catholic worker thing. That's the community that's fully, you know, they're really rural, and they but they identify more as Franciscan. So you can, but I'm happy the Catholic worker did a full article on them. And I think they're in too, but they're in Eastern Austria, and our gatherings are always in Northwestern Europe. And Ursula made it to one gathering, and it's usually us, the hamburgers, and us Amsterdam people visiting them. And there's the Maria Skopcova House, which was started by the London Catholic worker, the Giuseppe Conan House, because in Calais, the French, they do the border work for England. England wants to stay an island. And so they have a real tight border in Calais. It's on a point where already ever since the last ice age, that's where you cross over. Since the sea came back, it used to be, or you could walk into England, you know, when there was a lot of ice, but now there's a bit of sea, and that's the place where you cross. You can see Dover, you can just see England. And there's real bad border there, and there's the tunnel. So there's a lot of migrants trying to hop on the trains and into trucks to get to England. And Maria Skopcova House was started to be in solidarity with the migrants that the British system keeps out by using the French. And that's a tough place to be. So it's really the war of migrants that, you know, they build tents, and if you distribute food, you get arrested, and there's a lot of migrants there, and they get wounded, and oh boy. So the Maria Skopcova House is living ultra solidarity. And like Johannes from the London Catholic worker who kicked it off, he slept in the shower and gave his bed to, and it was very full, and it's still quite a house. And now Brendan, and I forgot his girlfriend's name, they run the place, and they're young, and they manage. Well, she works for a refugee organization, and they have some place where it's a little bit less front, but he's on the front line in the Skopcova House and living the solidarity. And he comes to the gathering hitchhiking, you know, so, and I'm already an old bourgeois, you know, I go by train or by car or whatever, but hitchhiking, I sometimes think, I should hitchhike, but it just, but he hitchhikes to the gathering. And then there's the Le Dorothée in Paris. And they came to the gathering once, and then COVID hit. And last year we had our first gathering post-COVID, and they somehow didn't make it. But the hamburgers visit them, and our Gerard is often in Paris, so there's links. And they have a big cafe, a lot of roundtable discussions. They're real intellectuals, like they understand theology and they know these words so they really are into discussion and the cafe. But they also give a job training for migrants, so they can have access into Europe. If you come as a very unskilled Western African, then they help you get job skills and start your life here. And that kind of stuff. And I heard that the bishop doubled the... Nah, that's rumors. But you should go there, Theo, and check it out. And then you can... Bill Griffin, he was there a couple of times. So he's the best one to hook up with. So yes, there's... there's Le Dorothée. And let me think... well, there's... I think there's a Peter Morin house in somewhere in Spain, and Gerard was just by accident, he stumbled on them, and they have links with Casa Juan Diego in Houston. But Spain is so far out that I never met them, and they're more in the Houston cloud than they're not in the Northwestern European breathing of Catholic worker fabric. Yeah.
Well, we've gone about as long as we normally go for an episode here, Fritz. Do you have any final thoughts about the Catholic worker or Europe or anything like that?
Well, an invitation. Usually our gatherings are around Ascension Day. And then sometimes they're on Pentecost. And we get together on the Wednesday before Ascension Day. Somehow Ascension Day is always a Thursday. I don't know exactly why. But and then we spend time together until Sunday. So if any one of you happens to be in Northwestern Europe around Ascension Day, think, there's a nice bunch of Catholic workers hanging out together. I might jump in. So that invitation I want to heartily share with you. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Fritz, for taking the time to share about it. It's really interesting and so much fun for us to kind of hear about what is going on all over the world with the Catholic worker. Well, we want to give a huge thanks to Fritz for working with us and figuring out time differences to be able to record this podcast. It was really a fun interview with Fritz. I'm hoping that some of his joy and enthusiasm is really able to come across in this recording.
I feel like I've said this on half the episodes we've recorded or more, but it's just always so interesting to hear folks' different adventures coming to the Catholic worker movement. And Fritz's was unlike anyone else we've had so far.
You know, I will say nobody has ever told me before coming to the Catholic workers with this group that was dropping refrigerators on top of people. That was a new one.
Yeah, that is pretty intense. I guess that's what you're going to do if you're going to seriously defend your squat against the police, though.
Sure. I thought it was really fascinating, and I do think that it is this sort of a little bit of a cultural difference of these ideas of squats and communal land. And the St. Louis worker had a Catholic worker squat for a little bit. But I don't know of a ton of other workers who have engaged in that sort of aspect of appropriating property back into communal use in that same way.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any, but it would make for a pretty big political statement. I mean, especially in an example of like the US, like there are so many empty homes, yet so many homeless folks. Maybe more Catholic workers should just be squatting houses as their hospitality house.
Well, that would be an interesting piece. It might be a little bit harder to recruit for, I imagine, to get a group together with that. So Theo, I know we've had a conversation about this before of ways in which it feels like there should be more overlap between some of these anarchist movements and the Catholic worker. Not that they're the same, but that there is this overlap in values to be able to allow people to sort of support each other, or for some crossover in the same way that Fritz was able to find the Catholic worker as sort of being this next step or progression in some of his thought.
Yeah, I do think that's very true. I don't know, it was like that for me, maybe folks will recall, like coming in through anarchy and finding the Catholic Worker as the next step. Or for Julie, coming in through Occupy, it's not necessarily an anarchist formation, but, you know, overlapping kind of anti-capitalist values or something like that. I think it's some of the most interesting people in the Catholic Worker movement have met it through those kinds of things. I think it really does behoove us to be making friends with different groups like that if we want to keep growing and doing clarification of thought and stuff.
I think it also brings in this other perspective of both strategy and emphasis, and also in some way of, oh, I don't know, of like lifestyle in a sense. Yeah, we're broadening who is included in the movement and who can sort of maybe included in the is the wrong word, broadening who can find themselves in the movement or find value in it. Seems like it is a worthwhile effort.
I think it would be unfortunate for the Catholic Workers if it was only Catholic people from like middle class backgrounds and stuff like that, and only people who found the Catholic Worker through that kind of Catholicness. I think if it's too many folks like that at the exclusion of folks from these other radical perspectives, I think it is not going to make for a healthy movement.
Sure. Yeah, we become sort of narrow then in our thought and focus. So you're actually getting to go out and visit some of the European Catholic Workers later in the summer. So that will be exciting for you to have the chance to go and see some of these communities and folks and that Fritz was talking about.
Yeah, I hope I get to see every single one of them that he mentioned. We'll see if it works out that way. He's always inviting folks to come to the European gathering. They do it each May. So if you're listening to this right now, you should reach out to Fritz if you can through the Joette Noel website. They'd love to have you join them for the European CW gathering.
Great. Maybe it will help kickstart some more houses over across the ocean. Well, that wraps up for us another episode of Coffee with Catholic Workers. If you'd like to reach out to us with comments, suggestions, clarification of thought, feel free to email us at coffeewithcatholicworkers@gmail.com. We want to thank Chris from the Bloomington Catholic Worker for help with editing, David Hayes for our music, and Becky McIntyre for our graphics.
Thanks for joining us again for some clarification of thought. We hope today's conversation and discussion have been enlightening, and maybe even that you're encouraged to go out and help build a world where it's easier to be good.